Greetings, friends. This talk introduces the third week's Truth of Happiness course Dhamma study on the Four Noble Truths and integrating Shamatha Vipassana meditation and the Four Foundations of Mindfulness into the broader framework of the Eightfold Path. Included at the end of the talk is a 20-minute Shamatha Vipassana meditation session. The talk concludes with meta-intentional meditation.
The Four Noble Truths. I'll introduce the Four Noble Truths, but before I do that, I was questioned a few times by the way that I put the book together. And so the eighth week is on dependent origination and the five clinging aggregates. And the question was, if the Buddha awakened to dependent origination, why didn't you teach that first and then let everything follow? The Buddha had developed everything before that in the book in order to understand dependent origination. So if I would, dependent origination says that from ignorance, through 12 observable causative links, stress and suffering and delusion and confusion arises. That doesn't really have a lot of meaning, does it? Even though it's what the Buddha awakened to. In order to understand that, he taught the rest of these teachings. So this ignorance that is the foundation of dependent origination, and dependent origination means that these things, in order to end up in a deluded, confused state, to not be able to understand reality, is founded on ignorance. But it's a very specific type of ignorance. The Buddha is not saying that human beings are ignorant. He recognizes, even back then, that we've all developed certain knowledge and skills on how to live in the world. So we're not ignorant people. But we're ignorant of one very specific fact. We're ignorant of the Four Noble Truths. And it's ignorant of these Four Noble Truths that lead to stress and suffering, delusion and confusion, and a life of an unsatisfactory life because we don't understand reality. So the Buddha didn't teach dependent origination in his first teaching. In fact, it was quite a while before he related those causative links. What he taught in his first teaching is called the Dhammakakapavattana Sutta, which means setting the wheel of truth in motion. So his very first teaching, he set the wheel of truth in motion, and that wheel of truth is still rolling today. In a lot of the modern Buddhist schools, it talks about different lineages, and these lineages are established through different charismatic teachers. But to me, they're all false lineages. The lineage that was established by the Buddha 2,500 years ago is the only lineage that's worth following. And that lineage is still available to us because the same teachings are available to us. We're engaged in that lineage right now because I'm talking about the Four Noble Truths and we're experiencing that in this room. That's the lineage of the Dhamma. It's expressed through the Four Noble Truths and the supportive teachings, not through somebody else's interpretation of what this means. That's a step removed from the reality of the Buddha's teaching. So when the Buddha gave this first teaching, this is about a month after he awakened, and he gave this teaching to the five colleagues that he wandered around northern India with for the previous 6 years, seeking enlightenment. Now, these five friends had dismissed the Buddha as someone who has now fallen off the path, because he left them and started he started eating a little bit of food. I don't want to give the whole life story of the Buddha, but he started eating a little bit more food, which they took as giving into sensual desire. But he had almost died from his ascetic lifestyle. He needed to eat a little bit in order to survive. And then he said, out of frustration for all these teachings that he chased after the previous 6 years, he said, none of these work. And they've almost killed me. Now I'm going to sit here in meditation until I awaken. And he sat down, and the legend is from one day to 40 some odd days. It doesn't really matter. The length of time is important. The Buddha sat in meditation with a strong intention, with right intention. I'm going to sit here, observe what occurs, and I'm going to stay here until I awaken. And over this period of time, the Buddha faced every one of his deluded beliefs, every one of his attachments. And the story that's given is quite mystical and magical. But what he's doing was facing all of his fears, all of his attachments, all the ways that he established himself in this phenomenal world, recognize them as impermanent projections, let every one of them go, and at some point during that period of time, he awakened. What did he awaken to? He awakened to these Four Noble Truths. So the Buddha sat for 2 more weeks after his awakening, considering, is this something that I can teach that people will understand? And is it worthwhile teaching? And he was concerned about that. He sat there trying to figure out, how can I teach it and should I teach it? And the conclusion that he came to was that if there's just a few people, and the words that's often used, with just a speck of dust in their eyes, meaning they're almost ready to understand, they just need a little nudge, a little bit of understanding, then it's worth teaching. And that's when he got up on his cushion, started walking down the road there in northern India. And his 5 friends saw him. At first, they said, well, we're going to shun the Buddha. We're going to let him know how we feel about him now. But as he got a little closer, they realized the radiance of this human being, and they said, he's got it. Our friend Shakyamuni awakened. And they sat down and listened to him. He gave this brief talk on the Four Noble Truths, and immediately one of the guys, his name was Kandana, awakened. And then over the course of a few more discourses, in fact, the next year's retreat is going to be on these first initial discourses. Over the course of these next 2 teachings, the other four fellows awakened. And they became the foundation for the modern Buddhist teachings. They became the first monks. There weren't such a thing then. Eventually, the Buddha started the order of the bhikkhus. He ordained them into this into his sangha. So the first teaching was on the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths state, the first truth is that there is suffering, there is dukkha. Dukkha means anything, any aspect of suffering, including an unsatisfactory experience in life. It can be minor or major physical or emotional suffering, but it's every aspect of that unsatisfactory nature of life. And if you think about the modern Western mindset, it's almost instilled in us. In fact, it's written in the Constitution that we have the right to pursue happiness. But how do we describe happiness? Everybody describes that differently. And most of us seek happiness as it relates to this thing called an ego personality. And that's different for everyone, isn't it? The second noble truth is craving and clinging originates dukkha, originates that unsatisfactory nature of life. And where does craving and clinging arise? It arises in this ego personality. And this ego personality continually conditions its mind towards establishing more of itself. The best example, I'm not putting down Donald Trump at all. I'm really not. And I had a discussion, and I wrote a brief article online about hating the Donald is the most un-Buddhist thing you can do. But he's a perfect example of an ego going run riot, isn't it? And if you believe what Donald Trump says, that's fine. Most people don't. Actually, that's not true. He might be the next president. A lot of people see what he says as pretty vicious, and I think most of it is. But I don't judge him harshly. I understand that it's coming out of confusion and delusion. I feel sorry for the man. And think of what he's stuck in. And he continually projecting this view of himself out in the world, that this is the right view. He believes it. It arises from craving and clinging, from seeing the world in a confused state. The third noble truth is that cessation of suffering is possible. This relates back to Anicca. If it wasn't for the third noble truth, we'd be in trouble. If the Buddha awakened and said, you know, there is this permeation of suffering in the world, and it's caused by craving and clinging. See ya. He wouldn't have done much for us, would it? But the next truth was, there is this suffering in the world that's common. It's a common human experience. And you cause it by craving and clinging. But there's a way out. And it's because of impermanence, because change is possible. And the fourth noble truth is that the path leading to the cessation of dukkha, to the cessation of craving and clinging, and the continual establishment of an ego personality that's prone to suffering, that path is the Eightfold Path. And then he expounded on the Eightfold Path. I won't do that in this talk, because that's what we get into that next week. But those are the four noble truths. There is suffering, there is dukkha. Craving and clinging originates or causes dukkha. There's a way out, cessation of that dukkha, of that confusion and unsatisfactory nature of life is possible. And the Eightfold Path is the path leading to that cessation. So then the Buddha taught how to develop concentration and the refined mindfulness through integrating the Eightfold Path into our lives. The last factor of the Eightfold Path is right meditation, or Shamatha Vipassana meditation. It comes at the end so that the understanding that the other seven factors are important to develop a complete understanding, but Shamatha Vipassana meditation supports the developing the other seven factors. So I said a lot in the last few minutes. Is that clear, though?
I have a question.
Please.
Can you make a distinction between craving and wanting? Because we are all driven by the things we want, and things we want are things that we think are going to make us happy.
Like, yep.
Taking a vacation next month.
Yep.
Or buying that nice coat, or starting a business that I've always wanted to do, that sort of thing. That's a wanting, but that's what keeps us motivated and going. So is that different than craving something?
Craving, wanting, desire, they're all the same thing. Now, in order to understand how we get in trouble through craving, we have to understand an ego personality. There's nothing wrong with planning a vacation, going on it, and enjoying it. There is something wrong when you create an identity about that, and you insist that we create all kinds of scenarios about vacations. They need to be a certain way in a certain place with a certain weather and a certain meal and all the other things. And when those things don't happen, when I go to Long Beach Island and it rains all week, I'm really disappointed because my ego personality wanted a sunny day every day. That's the problem. That creates the unsatisfactory nature. If there's no ego personality attached to going to Long Beach Island for a week, no matter what the weather is, no matter if Mustache Bills is still serving those good pancakes, then every moment is a satisfying moment. But if I place a condition because of my conditioned thinking that Mustache Bills better have those pecan pancakes and he's out of pecans, I'm unsatisfied with that moment in my life. So there's nothing wrong with planning our lives. There's nothing wrong with looking forward to developing a business. But do we have our ego personality attached to it? And are there conditions based, am I placing conditions in my life? So we can go forward to build a business. And putting every right effort into that. And again, the Eightfold Path is a great guide for even that. Through right speech, right action, and right livelihood. If we can use that to define how we build a business, we're not going to attach to an ego personality. So if that business prevails and is successful, it's not going to elevate our view of ourselves. And if it fails, it's not going to diminish who we think we are. We're not going to take it personally. We'll be more free to apply refined mindfulness to this development of this new business rather than coming at it from the viewpoint of an ego personality, which limits that amount of mindfulness.
And failure won't stop you.
Some of the great success writers of all time, Og Mandino comes to mind, talks about that point. If you don't take failure personally, meaning if you don't have your ego personality attached to it, then you can learn from it. But many people, if they're this is my project and this is what I'm going to show the world and it doesn't work, it crushes you and you never try anything again. He used an analogy. He brought up such a great point, Andrew. He brought up this analogy of a cat that jumped up on a hot stove and burned its paws and jumped off, never went up on that hot stove again. He's making the analogy to, or a metaphor, I always get those mixed up, to a human being that tries something and gets burned and never engages in the world in that way again. But when we don't have an ego personality attached to it, we just recognize it's part of the process of living in the world. So did that help your understanding a little bit of that craving?
Yeah.
Good. Susan?
An image that I keep in my mind if I start to get frustrated or feeling bad is I always think of a little one-year-old baby that goes up and down and up and down, and he, she, never gets frustrated when they're trying to learn how to walk. They just keep on doing it.
Yeah.
And they don't care if somebody sees them fall. And I was thinking maybe that's closer to not having as much of an ego personality because they're just driven and they don't get frustrated.
Yeah, they haven't had time to establish it either.
Excuse me, I wasn't until I started taking this class that I realized how much not joy I would get out of things that were supposed to be joyful because of... And the phrase that helped me kind of sum up what I think you're saying is getting attached to an outcome. just sort of a simple way of thinking about it.
Yeah.
When I'm planning a vacation, even with the people around me, helps me to say, you know, let's not get attached to an outcome when we're planning this. Let's not get attached to an outcome, Mom, when we're trying to plan this Christmas dinner, because so-and-so might not show up, and that will be okay. You know, we'll still have a good time. You know, it just somehow, that allowing things to unfold,
yeah,
and putting in your best effort to enjoying yourself rather than having it be trying to control every single detail.
Yeah. And that's placing conditions on
right.
What's likely to occur. And when we truly understand the interplay between anicca, anatta, and dukkha, then we cease doing that. Because we know that all things are impermanent. This thing that I think is a self isn't permanent either. There's no reason to take anything personally. And that there's an underlying unsatisfactory nature to anything that can occur because of understanding the impermanence. And understanding this interplay between these three facts of existence. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, I think that's far enough for today. So, again, this is what the Buddha taught as the Four Noble Truths. When he described awakening to the Four Noble Truths, and there's a series of four articles on this on the website that I won't be introducing, but you can look at it. Awakening to the First Noble Truth. Again, it's nothing magical, mystical, or esoteric in any way. When the Buddha described awakening to the First Noble Truth, he says that dukkha, the unsatisfactory nature of life, has been fully comprehended. We understand it. And it's something, again, this points back to the difference between Buddhism, the way the Buddha taught it, as a faith or as something that's to be experienced. He taught something that we can experience. It's not taken on faith that life is unsatisfactory. When we start developing this understanding, we can see it clearly. That's what Buddha's big awakening was. There's this unsatisfactory nature to life, and we want it to be different. So just to get back to what Andrew said just a few minutes ago, craving is initially the desire to continue to establish that which can't be established, anatta. And then clinging, once we start doing that through the five clinging aggregates, I touched a little bit on that this morning, once we begin to establish the self through craving, then the self starts clinging to objects, views, and ideas. And so then every object, view, and idea that occurs becomes an opportunity, a deluded opportunity, to continue to establish the ego personality in this vacation I might be taking next week, or the new car I'm getting to tomorrow, or that fight that I had with someone last week that I'm still carrying a resentment about, that person is wrong. That's all part of an establishing a self that creates an unsatisfactory experience in life, rather than seeing life as life occurs. And when we can do that, when we can develop the refined mindfulness that the Dhamma brings us, whatever occurs is just what occurs. When we have a wonderful experience, when a new baby is born into our family, we get to hold that baby for the first time, and we feel that incredible joy, the Dhamma doesn't say, "Oh, I shouldn't feel this. This is impermanent." You're aware of what's occurring, and you're aware of the whole experience of that little life coming into the world and what the significance of that. Or when any other thing occurs, when a friend brings us over a nice chocolate cake, we're able to really enjoy. I always go back to chocolate cake. We're able to really enjoy that without thinking anything about that. Well, now, what does this person mean by this? What are they trying to get? You're just there and you're present with it. And you're present with everyone. Your relationships take on a whole new experience because there's no expectations that you're putting on other people. You're not carrying anything with you into an experience. When you're planning a business, you've learned from your failures, but you're not attached to them, and they don't limit you in what you might do in the future because you're with life as life occurs. And so these are incredibly practical teachings. They're how to live our life moment by moment without being attached to the incredibly limiting experience of an ego personality, to that which the Buddha said is anatta. It's not a self. Let it go. It just limits you.
Get back to Trump.
Poor Donald.
That hairstyle. How would Trump handle not having the ability to maintain that hairstyle? I mean, that is a
that's a great question. Yeah, if you want
to. There's a lot of clinging to that hair. I used to cut hair way back in the day, and to get that kind of a
that's a lot of work.
That's an hour at least of prep.
Yeah, I didn't want to waste that time anymore. So,
so that's clinging, and that's not healthy.
it's such a good example of what can happen. That Donald wakes up tomorrow and all his hair fell out overnight. It's a great blow to his ego personality, isn't it? Rather than, this is just what happens to people sometimes. They lose their hair. When especially, it's a good teaching on the five clinging aggregates. He's so attached to his physical form with the high hair that when it changes, which it inevitably will do, he's devastated by it. And again, we're just using him as an example. Maybe he wouldn't be, but and he would be much better to let go of this view of himself that he sees in the mirror as him, you know, the strong identity, and say, that's just something impermanent, and it's going to change day by day. Then there'd be no, when he wakes up and his pillow's full of his hair, it's not going to bother him at all. Or when he doesn't, when he, well, I don't want to get, you kept using the dog. The reason why I brought him up, again, not to beat him up, is there was an article written by a very well-revered and famous Buddhist teacher that talked about how awful the Donald is, and you know, the basically that we should hate his guts. And if you have an understanding of what the Buddha taught, there's no way you could look at him that way. You just, for one thing, it hurts yourself. But to see another man who is that, again, I'm judging him, but just to use it as a, I believe that he's deluded in his thinking, like most human beings are. And it's led him to take some of these positions, like we should kill all the Muslims' families. That's a pretty extreme position. It's because he doesn't understand the three marks of existence. If he developed this understanding, he could not possibly act that way. So as we develop our own understanding of our deluded thinking and our own suffering, we understand it in human beings, and we won't attack them when they have a position that's different than ours. There's two great examples of that, and Pali, actually there's more than two, but I'll give you two real quickly. King Ashoka was the king of most of India about 250 years after the Buddha died. He was probably the most brutal, violent leader that the world has ever seen. He completely destroyed other small towns and cities and small civilizations in northern India at the time. And one of the great things the great pleasures that he took was when he went through a town and killed everybody, he cut their heads off and he put it on a pike. And you imagine these landscapes just covered with human heads. And he was so proud of this. He came across the Buddhist teachings and took to the Dhamma and awakened. And he never killed another human being, but he went even further than that. He established the first free health system for everyone. And he went even further than that. He established free veterinary care for animals. And he encouraged people to bring their sick animals because he couldn't stand the thought of any life ending. And he did everything he can. Even more than that, there's still rock edicts, E-D-I-C-T-S. I'm not quite sure what edicts, I think, is how you say it, all over northern India and Sri Lanka, because he sent people to bring the message down there, that are still present today, that still preserve the words of the Buddha. So again, one of the most violent people the world has ever seen was changed completely by the Dhamma. And another one was Angulimala, who was a murderer, a contemporary of the Buddha's. And he was so enamored with his murdering, and he so wanted people to know what he did, that he cut people's fingers off and he made a necklace around. He wore these fingers around his neck. And he had 99 when he came up across the Buddha, and he saw the Buddha walking down the street one day, and he said, there's number 100, I'm going to get that one. And he was intent on killing the Buddha. And he walked up to the Buddha. As he got closer, he was taken back by the Buddha's radiance. And the Buddha understood what Angulimala was all about. He explained the Four Noble Truths. Angulimala changed completely and awakened. He never hurt another soul. So it's through these direct teachings that we transform ourselves from any type of deluded thinking into awakened human beings. And again, King Ashoka didn't say, well, I'm awakened, I'm not going to bother with this. He took to his role in a very meaningful and awake way. and he became one of the great leaders of the world. Angulimala became a monk in the Buddha Sangha, and helped to spread the message. That's what happens when we let go of views. any questions about this talk on the Four Noble Truths? And so you understand now, this is the third week. We started with meditation, shamatha vipassana meditation, then we learned the four foundations of mindfulness, and they truly are the foundations for all mindfulness. And now we're involved in the Four Noble Truths and how these 3 weeks start fitting into the larger picture of the 10-week course and into the Eightfold Path, right? So next week we're going to, I'll introduce the Eightfold Path, but this week you'll read the chapter on the Four Noble Truths, and if there's any questions or comments about that, we'll talk about that next Saturday, right? And next Saturday I'll introduce the Eightfold Path in the next week. Good. So let's meditate, and I'll give a little bit of instruction on meditation. And then I usually end our meditation with a certain type of intentional meditation. I want to read something to end the class today. It's from the Karaniya Metta Sutta, which is a sutta on metta, a direct sutta that the Buddha gave. And the words are a little bit different, but it's a really nice way to end it, just to change up metta a little bit. So, shamatha vipassana meditation. Shamatha means to quiet the mind, to develop a tranquil mind, and vipassana means to gain insight. And so we use this technique to first quiet the mind, and then to gain insight, but it's a very specific type of insight. It's insight into these three marks of existence, into anicca, anatta, the not-self characteristic, and to dukkha. And then within the wider framework that we learn meditation, these understandings become clear to us. So it's not just meditation. If you're starting a meditation practice, I suggest just start with 2 or 3 or 4 minutes a day, twice a day. Consistency is much more important in establishing a meditation practice than length of time. So don't feel like you have to meditate for 20 minutes. We will today. But if you can do that every day, the best time to meditate, I think, is as soon as you get up in the morning before you get involved in your day, and then around 12 hours later. There's a booklet out there, I think I mentioned that, and there's a recording of shamatha vipassana on the website, too, that you can listen to that will help you start your practice. The most important thing is to maintain the method and don't judge the method or yourself harshly. If you're maintaining the method and just sitting, the benefits will be there in developing it within that larger framework. So, and now I'll talk you into it. So gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And holding your back straight, but not stiff, your ears aligned with your shoulders, nose aligned with your navel, and holding yourself very loosely, very gently, very lovingly. Allow yourselves to settle into this room, settle onto your seats, settle into your bodies, and settle into your minds. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And if you can pick up your breath right at the tip of your nose, place your mindfulness there. And while remaining mindful of your breath in your body, notice that thoughts are flowing. We're conscious beings, thoughts should be flowing. The purpose of shamatha vipassana meditation is to not be distracted by our own thoughts. So when you notice that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. Excuse me. I'll repeat that. When you notice that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. Putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. And we'll meditate for 20 minutes. putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. Thank you. aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. Not following a thought with a thought, remaining mindful of our breathing. If a persistent thought or feeling arises, stay with it for a moment or two. Recognize it as impermanent and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. And we'll meditate for 5 more minutes. Take a moment to notice the quality of your mind. Be at peace with your mind. And when you're ready, gently open your eyes. Katie, how was that?
It's hard.
Yeah, 20 minutes is a long time for a first stint. So like I said, 2 or 3 minutes consistently, you'll have a meditation practice. But I think you've seen how important to be part of a sangha, be part of a group too, is maintaining that. Well, I'm glad you sat with us today.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions or comments before we finish? No, you have your homework. Andrew? Yep, read the Four Noble Truths and we'll introduce the... And if you want to catch up the talks, the Dhamma talks are on two different spots right now. I put up a page for our group discussion, and that's linked, and the Saturday talks are on that page. The Tuesday talks are on the Truth of Happiness course talks pages, and as we're moving through the course, I'm updating those talks too, so the first 3 weeks are new on that. And that you can catch up there too. our current Dhamma project is we're taking donations to buy a share of produce for a local family from Tinicum CSA, and there's a box out there that you can fill up. I think that's the only announcement that I have right now. So, and we're going to finish. We always finish with metta, but I want to change it up a little bit and. This portion of metta is the metta that I often recite is comes from the Metta Sutta, but it's my own interpretation of it, and this is another interpretation of the Karaniya Metta Sutta by a monastery called Amaravati, which is in a well-established monastery in England, a Theravadan monastery, and I just I've been wanting to. Read it for a while, but so if you want to again close your eyes and become mindful of the sensation of breathing and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distractions to the past or the future or anything that's arisen from our talk tonight. And the Buddha's words on loving kindness. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects her life, her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again in this world. So thank you all for joining this morning. Peace.
Thank you, John.
Great class. Thank you all. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.